Linoleum Knife.
A podcast of the cinema.
Starring Alonzo Durrell Day.
And Dave White.
That you're Alonzo Durrell Day.
And you're Dave White.
You are the rap. Wait. You're the reviews editor at the Wrap. You're the co-host of What the Flick?
No,
which is now called, sorry. You're the co-host of Breakfast All Day.
Listen to your own screed from last week.
You're a co-host of Breakfast All Day, which used to be called What the Flick. Go back to last week's episode and I will yell at you about it. Go then also to the Maximum Fun Network and listen to him co-host the podcast known as Who Shot Ya?
Correct. You are a film critic for The Wrap.
And you can read my review of High Life this week on the site. And if you go backwards in time to last week, you can read my review of The Beach Bum.
Mm-hmm.
Two reviews in 2 weeks.
Wow.
I'm tired. That is not happening again anytime soon. When will that happen again? What am I doing next for you?
Poor you.
I don't think I've got anything going on with you until the end of this month again now, right?
Maybe end of May, I think.
It's like middle of May or something like that.
I don't know.
Some documentary?
Right? Yes.
I can't remember now. I don't know anything.
You will meet your deadlines when I tell them.
I always meet my deadlines.
You do.
I turn in clean copy,
mm-hmm.
and I meet my deadlines.
It's true.
I mean, my copy isn't always clean. Like, sometimes it needs help, but like... Most of the time, I'm a pleasure to edit. I think that's the case, right?
The zhuzhing is pretty minor for you, yeah.
Yeah. Because I'm a very valuable freelancer.
It's true.
For my editor named Alonzo Duralde.
You were the film critic at movies.com for a whole long time.
Without an editor.
Yes.
To speak of.
Just so. Me, again.
So, yeah. So all of my mistakes are on movies.com, provided they haven't wiped every bit of what
they
I wrote.
They might have. I don't know what's going
Who
on.
Knows?
I don't even know if my DVD obscuras are still there.
They're not. I bet they're not.
Yeah, well.
I bet they're just destroying everything over there. From
Nothing gold can stay.
Who cares? I just saw a thing on YouTube. You know I hate a hack.
A life hack?
A life hack. I can't stand them. Don't show me a hack.
Oh.
Don't show me any hacks.
Come on. That one where you take the Nutella jar that has the bits of Nutella sort of stuck at the bottom, and you put in vanilla ice cream, and then you scrape out the last bits of Nutella with the ice cream. That's a good life hack.
When did that happen?
That's been around.
Was that on the internet?
Mm-hmm.
All right, I approve of that one.
Okay.
If only because you want to get all the Nutella out of the jar.
don't mass, you know, badmouth life hacks.
In general, let's say I'm speaking in generalities.
Okay.
I hate life hacks.
All right.
But I just saw one on YouTube that maybe I'll try it. Maybe I'll try it.
What does it involve?
Well, it involves a box cake. You know.
Okay.
You know how I am.
This isn't a box cake with soda, right? We talked about
that. No, we've done that. You know how, like, you get a box cake when you're too lazy to make a real cake?
Yeah.
Because I love making a real cake, as you know.
Sure.
I made a little cakey banana muffins this morning.
Yeah, you did.
It's essentially very similar to making a cake.
Except they don't fall.
Except they don't fall because they're small.
Right.
They're so small that you got to work to make a muffins fall.
You got to have a disco dance party in your kitchen.
The thing, so, okay, I'm a fan of making a cake from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
I know how to do it. I can do the process just in my sleep.
But sometimes you want a Duncan Hines.
Sometimes you want a Duncan Hines box cake. You just want one because they taste different.
There's pudding in the mix.
Well, not usually. That's not the way they are usually. They used to market them.
Yeah.
But here's a little packet of goo that you can squeeze into it and make it.
Oh, I thought it was just more. I thought it was like powdered pudding.
Well, sometimes it was that too.
Okay.
But there was a woman on YouTube who was like, all right, here's what I do with a box cake. Put the box cake, open up the package, pour it in the bowl. Instead of adding the oil, see, on a box cake, they always tell you add oil or water
And one egg, right?
An egg, or sometimes water and oil and eggs. Mm. All right. So this one,
and you know the whole thing, the egg, the original box cakes didn't need them.
Didn't need them, but
people didn't like them because they didn't think they were doing enough.
Right, right. She substitutes like everything.
Okay.
So instead of all the things it tells you on the box, mm-hmm. she substitutes milk for water.
Okay.
Melted butter for the oil.
Okay.
And ups the number of eggs just based on whatever she feels like putting in the number. Like, if the cake mix says put in 2 eggs, she puts in 4.
Okay.
I gotta say, just the thought of all this mm-hmm. seems like it might be pretty good.
What's it gonna do?
I don't know. She says it makes it better. I guess I have to find out, right?
I guess you do. I will be your guinea pig.
I mean, it's not going to ever be like making a real cake.
No. But people we know will smell it and go, this is a box cake.
Oh, no. Okay, I'm sorry. So there's one more thing that she does.
Uh-huh.
She adds a box of Jell-O instant pudding into the mix.
Okay.
And so, the same flavor as the cake mix.
Well, yes, obviously. Yeah.
So
what would you add for like yellow? Vanilla?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Or whatever. I don't know. I've never bought a box of Jell-O instant pudding, so I don't know the answer.
Don't snap at me like these are dumb questions.
I'm willing to try for the sake of
pleasure. Science?
Yeah, for the sake of my mouth.
Yeah. that's what
I guess also.
None of that sounds bad.
I guess also I would do it for linoleum knife and fork.
I guess you would.
We'll talk about that later.
Yes.
But I'm now, it's now in my head. Like, I'm thinking about it now in my head.
Okay.
It's going to be the kind of thing that smells like a box cake, you know, and will not pass
the sniff test,
the Ann Fishbein test. But
I vote that you do this with a chocolate cake and add chocolate
instant
pudding.
Instant chocolate pudding, right.
And then frost it with whatever.
And then substitute chocolate milk for the water.
Well, here's the thing, though.
Come on, you know that'd be all right.
But chocolate milk is generally always low-fat milk.
Is it?
Yeah. So if you're adding the milk as a thing for the batter, you want whole milk.
What if I make whole milk?
And put Quick in it?
And put like some, what if I put that Ovaltine in it? That malted milk Ovaltine with the chocolate cake?
The non-chocolate.
It'll be like a chocolate malt cake.
Yeah. Maybe.
Oh, I think I'm right. Plus, who cares if it's extra sugar? Because the stuff's beyond sweet anyway.
We're eating a box cake.
You're eating a box of sugar.
I'm in for all of this.
This is a podcast about movies.
Yes.
This is just the thing that I was looking at before we sat down on the microphone. Mm-hmm. And I had to say it out loud so I could remember it. So you could hold me to my promise.
All right. So maybe you don't hate life hacks as much as you thought you did.
I'm still going to hate them.
Okay.
I think this might be the exception rather than the rule. Right. And who knows? It might suck.
Always a possibility.
It could also be very bad. You don't know.
I do not.
What you also don't know is about me and pet cemeteries.
Yes.
We're going to talk. Wait, hang on. We have 6 movies to talk about.
Correct.
We have exactly 70 minutes to get it all done in.
All right.
Because if I don't start roasting that chicken, mm-hmm. there ain't going to be no Sunday dinner. Mm-hmm. That chicken's got to get in the oven.
Well, then maybe we shouldn't be killing so much time on box cake.
This is not killing time. This is not killing time. The fuck? This is part of my cinema discussion.
Your practice?
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
Listen, think of me as Jean Dielman making a cake.
You've got a very exciting new potato soup recipe.
Meatloaf. She made a meatloaf.
She makes potato soup.
She also makes meatloaf.
Oh, fine.
Yeah.
Then I'm not wrong.
Are you sure she makes potato
soup? She totally makes potato soup.
It's such a long time ago, and that's a very long movie, and she makes so many different foods. in that film in real time.
Hashtag 52 films by women, y'all.
Yeah. I saw Pet Sematary.
Uh-huh.
You saw Shazam.
Correct.
So we're gonna do field reports.
Fine.
Because you didn't see Pet Sematary. I didn't see Shazam. For the same reasons, pretty much. Like, you just couldn't muster the enthusiasm.
Yeah, I never saw the first one either. And so I was like, do I have to watch the first one first so I can compare them? And do I care about either of them? And I don't, so.
And I felt that way about Shazam.
Okay.
Like, I saw the trailer, and
you are more the horror guy, and I'm more the superhero guy.
Based in terms of, you know, genre film stuff. Okay, yeah, sure. I saw the trailer for Shazam, which is weird because I don't usually see trailers, but let me guess what happens in Shazam. You can talk about that first.
Okay.
Here's my guess about what happens in Shazam.
Mm-hmm.
Kid gets big, becomes Shazam.
Right.
Acts like an obnoxious brat, even though he's a grown person now as Shazam.
Yes.
Has to learn how to be earnest and real and emotional while solving whatever crimes that Shazam has to solve.
You're not wrong.
Okay.
But.
Explain the movie.
Okay.
What does happen?
All right. Are you familiar with this character? Did you watch like that weird 70s live action version?
When I was a young child, they had a terrible Saturday morning live action show called the Shazam Isis Hour, right?
I think so. But first it was just Shazam. Isis came along later.
All right. And this kid with like David Cassidy shaggy hair.
Uh-huh.
And an old dude in a leisure suit. And they drove around in an RV.
Correct.
And they Shazammed him. And he did, I don't know. I don't know what happened.
Did you go
to, I was mostly flipping the channel to American Bandstand by that point.
Did you go to the panel I did at the Paley years ago with Michael Gray, who played Billy Batson on that show?
No. When did that happen?
This was some time ago. I don't know. Not there.
Were you conducting the Q&A for this panel?
Uh-huh.
I have no memory of this. I must not have been there.
Oh.
Maybe I said, you go have fun at work, dear. That might have been what I did.
He was very nice.
I'm sure he was.
Yes. So
what's he do now?
I want to say he has like a landscaping business or something.
Cool.
Yeah. Anyway, this is a character who's been around since the 40s, was originally called Captain Marvel, not to be confused with the other Captain Marvel, and that's a rabbit hole we're not even going to go down.
Because I'm confused now.
Okay. In the 40s, Fawcett Comics created this character as a ripoff of Superman.
Yeah.
His name was Captain Marvel. His magic word was Shazam, which is an anagram for the powers that he has.
That part I knew, actually, and I don't know how I knew that.
Yeah, the wisdom of Solomon, the strength of Hercules. It's like Achilles, Zeus.
The singing ability of Aaliyah.
Yes. And then the Mambo number 5. Anyway, so... then DC sued them, and then they wound up sort of owning the character, and then Marvel created Captain Marvel in the late 60s, their own, because they were able to own that. And so then when DC brought Shazam back in the early 70s, they kind of had to call him Shazam because they couldn't call him Captain Marvel anymore.
I see.
It was a whole weird thing. Anyway. So, yeah, basically, Billy Batson, young orphan in the comics, he like worked for a radio station. He was a news reporter like Clark Kent.
Right.
But here he is, we see early on in his childhood at a carnival, he loses his mom at this carnival and goes into the foster care system. and is constantly running away from Foster.
Loses her how? Well, she abandons him.
She abandons him. But he's convinced that, like, you know, if he keeps looking for her, he's going to find her.
All right.
And he keeps running away from foster homes trying to find her. And he winds up in this new foster home that seems to be really nice. And the people running it are former foster kids themselves. And Billy is still very suspicious and, you know, not down for it. But, like, one of the kids there is this kid named Freddy, who's kind of a motor mouth and obsessed with superheroes. This is the DC universe, so, like, Superman and Batman are actual people in this universe that people get obsessed with. And one day on the subway, Billy winds up in the lair of Shazam, this wizard played by Jaimin Hansu. He is given these powers. And over the years, we find out that Shazam, the wizard, had brought other people to his chamber and rejected them as inheritors of his power for one reason or other. One of the people that he rejected was Dr. Savannah, who is the bad guy here. He winds up being possessed by the seven deadly sins and wants to steal the Shazam powers away from Billy. Billy has to learn how to be a grown-ass man, even though he is a 12-year-old in a grown-ass man's body of Zachary Levi when he says the magic word. And, of course, come to understand the power of family. It is better than I make it sound. It's a lot of fun. It is a lot of fun. It is occasionally tonally off. It's directed by the guy who made Annabelle Creation and Lights Out.
I saw the trailer for the next Annabelle Creation movie.
Okay.
While I was at Pet Sematary.
Uh-huh.
It's like more of her.
It's kind
of
how sequels work.
She comes back to a house. Some kid goes in and gets her out of her glass case. And is like, I'm not scared of you, man. And you're like, girl, don't touch that doll. That's Annabelle Creation. She's going to chop off your head in your sleep.
I like that's her name now, Annabelle Creation. Like Jonathan Grooming.
Sorry to interrupt you.
There are a few.
I was bored with your description. So how does that mean? What does that mean to me sitting through this entire film?
Well, okay, it's a superhero movie and it's an origin story, but it has a kind of youthful, goofy point of view to it. You know, Zachary Levi gives a very assured comic performance. He's doing a lot of sort of fun physicality of, like, I'm a big strapping superhero, but inside I'm a dorky 12-year-old. Right,
because he's not just a tall person. He's like 6'5" or something. Like, he's a big, tall dude. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
You know, so, but he gets the body language down of, like, I have a 12-year-old inside me, you know, right, basically. And, you know, there's just a spirit of fun to the movie, I think. And it's colorful and it's bright and it's not grim dark at all. Like I said, there are a couple scenes where I think the director kind of loses that thread and it does get a little dark. And, like, you know, a lot of people are saying, don't bring little kids to this. And they're not wrong. But if you are not a little kid, you know, you'll
Is too little?
Don't ask me. Christy took 9-year-old Nick and he was fine.
Listen, she probably took him to see High Life, too. So.
This is true. He's not the gauge. I don't know. Google it. You'll find any number of parental columns telling you what kids to bring or not bring. Anyway, I had fun with this. I thought it was really charming. And
is it more than just a fun, you know, diversion? Is it about something?
I mean, it is about, as dopey as it sounds, it is about this kid kind of learning to be part of this family. And we don't see a lot of foster families on screen. We don't see a lot of ethnically diverse foster families where one of the kids walks with a crutch.
Okay.
But, you know, these kids all do have individual personalities that are brought interestingly into play as the plot proceeds. Yeah, I think it's worth seeing. I think you'd have fun.
Can I wait for it to show up? There's going to come a moment when it's going to just show up at this front door on Blu-ray.
Not necessarily.
There's a wash of stuff that comes into this house.
The DVD column I cover doesn't usually do, like, the big, you know, you'll note I get a lot of cult stuff and classics and TV.
Art house kind
of stuff. I don't get a lot of, like, big new releases. But look, okay, are you asking, can you watch this on HBO?
Yeah.
Yes, you can watch this on HBO.
All right. I don't need, it's not going to blow me over with its...
Not necessarily
big spectacleness. I can catch it.
Yeah,
If you like my pajamas. Yes,
if you like these kind of movies.
Made a hacked box cake.
Exactly. If you like these kind of movies and you like seeing them on the big screen, you'll like seeing this one on the big screen. But for you, you could wait. You're not going to.
I love the idea of just not going. I love the idea of waiting, seeing it.
Oh, but you're going to Avengers Endgame.
Well, yeah, because that's like, I've been conditioned now over the course of many years to accept my fate as a film critic and understand my role in the world of having to talk about it the minute it comes out.
Right.
Not that my voice or opinion on these things matters one bit. I think me talking about High Life or the new Jafar Panahi film means more. Not just because I think those films are more meaningful, but because I think that even the people listening to this podcast are more often here for that than they are for,
well,
what do I think about the new,
you also
what
know,
do I think about Shazam?
You know more about the Claire Denis filmography than you know about the history of Marvel Comics.
This is also the case. She's my Wonder Woman. Wrong universe, I know.
I'll see Shazamming. I'll Shazam it.
I'll tell you that,
but I don't want to sound like I'm just sloughing this off, just because so many of the DC movies for so long were dreadful.
Are dour.
And Wonder Woman obviously was an antithesis to that. Aquaman. I like this a lot more than Aquaman.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, I did enjoy Aquaman.
Because Aquaman I found kind of boring at times, and I didn't. I found the story sort of all over the place. This, I thought, had more of kind of a narrative through line to it.
Okay.
So there's that.
Well, see, now you're making me think otherwise.
All right. You liked Aquaman more than I did, but I like this one more than Aquaman.
Here's my next question.
Okay.
Why have they done, I don't know if this is it, the way it looks in the movie, but why have they squozed down his man area into like a smooth nothing? Is that how he looks in the movie too? Because the posters?
Well, that's what they do.
And the buses, the bus ads and stuff, I'm like, what you?
That's general.
Is there a, what?
That's general practice to crotches on a poster or on the side of a bus.
I want to know what.
I mean, think about.
Not,
it.
I'm not asking this from a prurient standpoint.
No, I know, but I'm just saying. When's the last
does
time?
Does he have a penis in this movie?
I would venture to guess yes. I don't remember.
All right.
There was a lot of other things happening, so I wasn't really looking. But
you never look where you're supposed to look.
I've seen it once. Maybe I'll have a second viewing that's just about that. But as you know, in any kind of large form advertising,
yes,
you know, there's always going to be airbrushing, or, you know.
Not if it's David Beckham for Emporio Armani.
Well, okay, that's...
How about that?
That's the exception, mm-hmm. because
What's
that's
up?
What the whole focal point of the ad is.
Right, but when you've got like a 10-foot, you know, billboard or bus ad,
uh-huh.
you know, on the side of a bus, and there's this giant human being, and your face is like that level on the, like, you're looking right at it, and you're like, you got a Ken doll to be in this
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, well,
what's
that's
happening?
But that's how they make that stuff look. Look, it's probably just his head on some, I don't even know. Maybe it's his body also. I don't know. There's a lot of digital manipulation that happens, but they always take that stuff out of posters, especially for a movie that's being aimed at children.
Children need to learn about penises. They exist. They're real.
They need to learn at home and not from Captain Marvel.
Why not? Why can't there just be... Why
Sorry,
can't,
from Shazam.
Why can't Captain Marvel just have a... like a dance belt or something? Like...
Okay, we're getting way off track.
I don't think it's off track. I think this is really, like, relevant. All right.
This is how advertising works. Don't blame the movie.
Pet Sematary.
Yes, tell me everything, please.
I wish I knew was I didn't stay for the credits because I really had to go to the bathroom. I wish I knew who did the cover of the song Pet Sematary.
The Ramones song?
At the end of this Pet Sematary remake. In the original film, the Ramones sing a song called Pet Sematary. It is over the closing credits of the film. And in this movie, some other band does the cover. Why did they have to do that? Why couldn't they just have the Ramones version?
Because that's what you do with a remake. It's a way to show, like, hey, man, this is the
right
2019 version.
I am reminded of last week's visit to the film Dumbo.
Yeah.
And the toxic decision to allow the Arcade Fire to cover the song Baby Mine, both in the film and over the closing credits. And it is a wan, anemic affair.
Good use of wan.
Thank you. This is a lesser version of Pet Sematary over the closing credits, but let's discuss the film. I've never read the book. So after seeing this version, I consulted our friend, Kevin Quigley.
A published expert.
He is a published expert in the subject of Stephen King. He's a Stephen Kingologist. And he, I texted him and I said, all right, this movie version deviates from the original in a pretty significant way.
Starcrawler. Yes.
I don't know who that is.
Me neither.
And I don't care. And I'm sorry. I'm sure you're all very nice people. Unless you're not. But I don't want to be hearing no other version of the song Pet Sematary unless it's the Ramones. Here's the story. A family. The father is a doctor. The mother is a stay-at-home working woman. They have two children. A little girl and a toddler son. Little girl's about 8, 9 years old. They move to a wooded area in Maine. That's your first mistake. Maine is a beautiful place. The minute you move next to the woods, you're in trouble. Because you've either got a witch living out there, or some haunted cemetery, or like the strangers, whatever it is, something very bad is in that woods.
They go live on by the shore, you know.
Right. The worst that'll happen to you there is the Jaws or a tsunami. So they go live in this place by the woods. They find that there is a pet cemetery on their property. The old man next door tells them all about it.
Soup!
Yeah. And there's an added complication to this little town. The road they live on, so their house is right between a pet cemetery and the most dangerous road in all of North America, where apparently there is no law and giant 18-wheelers race down it at 100 miles an hour, killing animals left and right.
The realtor didn't point this out.
Are you going to point out that kind of thing if you want to sell the house? I think Annette Bening is going to be like, oh, by the way, I really am here to sell this house today, but I must warn you that there's a haunted pet cemetery behind your home and also an incredibly dangerous stretch of highway in your front yard.
But that's why this property is such a steal.
On the very first day of the doctor's new job, he is confronted with an accident victim who dies immediately on his table. And then the accident victim immediately comes to life and begins haunting the doctor. Then the next door neighbor, old man, says, Well, you know, there's not just a pet cemetery behind your house. There's this other part of the land behind the pet cemetery.
The annex, if you will.
Yeah, it's the adjacent cemetery. And if you go bury something in the part that's behind the pet cemetery, maybe that thing will come back to life. This beloved pet that you've always, you know, hoped you could spend more time with. So they, the cat dies. They have a really great cat. And the cat gets run over by one of the big trucks. So they take it behind the pet cemetery. They bury it. Cat comes back.
The very next day.
Oh, yeah. This cat is not exactly the same.
Uh-huh.
This cat has a taste for terror.
And tuna.
No, more than tuna. So then...
Hang on.
Then the crazy things start to happen.
Okay.
And in the middle of the movie, two-thirds of the way through, is when the big change comes.
The big change from previous versions.
Yeah. Can I tell you what happens in the previous version? I can. It's a 30-year-old film.
Yes, yes.
All right. In the 30-year-old version...
Directed by Mary Lambert.
Directed by Mary Lambert. The toddler son is also hit by a big, fast-moving truck.
Mm-hmm.
Then they take it to, they take the corpse of the toddler to its funeral, where a family brawl breaks out, which is crazy, because like they knock the little coffin off its pedestal onto the ground, like the kid's body rolls out.
Oh, man.
Oh yeah, the one from 1989 is, it's not scary at all. But it is hilarious, and it is also super oozy, gross, and gnarly. So it's fantastic. This little toddler kid, after he gets put back in the place next to the pet cemetery, he comes back to life, and he just starts stabbing everybody with dad's scalpel, like murdering people. Like, he murders the kindly next-door old man, played by Fred Gwynn of the Munsters.
Uh-huh.
And he, and then he eats the guy's neck. And the craziest thing is that it's the child. It's like this little toddler that they've somehow managed to direct. It's not a
special effect.
To do, no, it's not a special effect child. It's a little kid just gnawing on someone's neck.
Probably not that hard to direct.
I just thought that was fantastic.
Okay, so if the 89 one is goopy and
oh,
goopy.
Hang on, it gets better. Because then the little toddler kid... starts killing, like, all kinds of everybody, including the mom, Denise Crosby, who then gets taken out and buried behind the pet cemetery so that she comes back to life at the end. So you've got now undead toddler and undead mom, whose face is half gone and is oozing green stuff, and the final scene of the movie is she's making out with the husband.
Ew!
It's the best. Now this one...
Without getting into spoilers.
This one deviates from what we know. And furthermore, according to Kevin, deviates from the book. I like the original better.
Huh.
Because neither of them are frightening. Unless you're into jump scares. If jump scares are what does it for you, then this movie has plenty. This version has plenty of jump scares, and a couple of them actually caught me by surprise.
No.
Yeah, which is, you know, not usually the case.
Got to get up pretty early in the morning.
I'm pretty good at determining when the jump scare is coming.
Uh-huh.
But this, they got me twice in this one.
Well.
But it's not, there's no suspense, there's no dread building, there's no, it's nothing scary. This one takes a lot longer to get moving, because they're trying to build atmosphere That's not really happening. And then comes the change stuff, the stuff that doesn't...
That's new.
The stuff you're not expecting, the stuff that's new. And that's where it gets interesting. That's when one very specific actor's performance becomes riveting. I'm not going to tell you who, but you'll know who when it happens. Because you're not really paying all that much attention to this person until the big change.
I see.
And then this person steals the movie.
Huh.
Yeah. Also, it ends radically differently than the original film. And by the time it ends, I was on board. Like, I was, honestly, I bought a ticket to see this yesterday. And about halfway through, I thought, why ain't nothing happening? What if I just left? I could go downstairs right now, get like a frozen yogurt, wander around CB2, look at the new furniture for spring. This is clearly a more boring version of Pet Sematary. But then the big change happens. And it becomes interesting. And I was on board for that last chunk. It just takes that long. It takes that long to get moving.
Gotcha. It's a good thing you didn't leave then.
It is a good thing I didn't leave. It is also not as wacky violent as the first.
Is it as wet as the original?
No. No, no, no. It is neither. It is neither as wet nor as viscous as the original. So, the original's better.
Okay.
This one's fine. The last 30 minutes, especially. Okay. So, if you're a completist and you're curious and you must see it, then fine.
If y'all get a chance, go over to the Wrap where William Bibbiani has written a ranking list of big screen Stephen King adaptations. And it's like 42 movies. God. It is an impressive... The scale is extraordinary.
Bibbs is a machine, and I don't know how he does it sometimes. It seems like he's always watching something. I don't know when he sleeps.
Yeah.
I don't know how he maintains this commitment to watching.
Every
watching,
so often on Twitter, he'll be like, now watching, you know, like Dolores Claiborne. I'm like, oh, I guess you're working on that King piece. Like, it's always something with him.
Right.
It's impressive.
It's admirable. I can't do it.
No, me neither.
I need naps. Why don't we talk about, quickly, let's talk about Gloria Bell.
Okay.
Gloria Bell has been out for
a couple of weeks.
You know what? We went through all of Pet Sematary without me even telling you who was in the film.
I was wondering about that.
Jason Clarke plays the father, the doctor. Amy Simons plays the mom.
John Lithgow
plays the Herman Munster part. And so, yeah, sorry. I forgot the names of the people. Ooh. I didn't forget the names. Imagine, I forgot to say the names of the people.
Imagine John Lithgow as Herman Munster.
I can't. There's only one.
There's only one Herman Munster.
There's only one Herman Munster.
Oh, fine.
I came home yesterday and said what I thought was a fairly funny Munster's joke to you. About the ending of the new version. And
it made me laugh.
I can't tell it on the mic because...
It would be a spoiler.
Not because it's profane, but because it would be a spoiler.
Yes.
So anyway, Gloria Bell has been out for about 4 weeks now.
Yeah.
And...
I'm just now getting to it.
You saw it before it opened.
Yes.
And then you said, oh, I'll wait to talk about it with you until you've seen it. And then I finally bought a ticket to go see it this week.
So Gloria Bell is a remake of a Chilean film called Gloria,
yes,
both directed by Sebastián Lelio,
yes,
who did Disobedience and A Fantastic Woman.
Yeah.
And Gloria Bell stars Julianne Moore as a middle-aged woman. She is divorced. Her children are grown up. She is trying to figure out, basically, you know, she's at an age where maybe she'll get into another relationship, maybe she won't. She likes to go dancing once a week. And so I think the movie's sort of like, is she going to dance into the rest of her life alone or with a partner? Mm-hmm. There's a possible partner milling about, played by John Turturro.
Oh, yeah.
But he comes with lots of baggage. And it's up to Gloria to decide.
I wanted to punch him in the face.
It's up to Gloria to figure out when is the deal breaker with this guy.
Oh, she lasts for far too long.
Oh, yeah.
When the deal breakers are dropping left and right.
Like anvils.
And there's one moment in the film, I won't give it away. There's one moment in the film where you think, all right, she's done with him. And then she's not.
I know.
And when they show you them together again, it was all I could do not to yell at the screen.
No!
Yeah. So Julianne Moore executive produced this film, which, you know what? I don't begrudge any actress anything it takes to get them the roles they want.
Sure.
This was, I guarantee you, her seeing the original and thinking, I want the English language version.
Yeah.
I want it. And I'm going to make it happen so that I can have it. And she did. So, I don't know the story behind that, but she's an EP, and that means she helped put it together.
It's interesting that she is an EP, because this is the nakedest I've seen Julianne Moore in a movie in a while.
Since Shortcuts.
Well, maybe not that far back, but, you know, it's... Yeah, there's a lot of Julianne Moore here. But, you know, she...
She chose to be this naked
on
screen.
If you can, do, you know.
Yeah.
No, but she gives an extraordinary performance, I think. It is, there's a lot to this woman, and I think it would have been very easy to be condescending about her, because, like, she sings the most...
About the character.
About the character, yeah.
Yeah.
Because, Gloria Bell is the kind of woman who sings the most banal love songs at full volume in the car and believes every word of them.
Everyone does that. Come on. Come on. When Total Eclipse of the Heart comes on the radio,
okay, yes.
Are you not singing along?
But come on. But All Out of Love?
That too. That's one of the worst songs ever written. And you know what? If it comes on the radio, I'm like, oh yeah, freedom rock, turn it up. Let's go.
Wow. This is something I did not know.
Oh, I'll do. I'll sing with anything in the car. And I've got a beautiful karaoke.
Oh, yes.
A beautiful karaoke
Haunting.
Voice. Yes, it'll move you to tears.
Yes. Go listen to Good Christian Fun. You can hear Dave belt along to Amy Grant. Anyway, she, I think, really gets to the heart of this character and makes her vulnerable, but also strong, but also, you know, there's a lot happening in there. I think she's quite good.
This is such a lovely, gentle film about, you're absolutely right, a woman that other filmmakers might condescend to, other actresses might even condescend to this character if they were given the chance or told that that's how they wanted it played. But they don't do that here, neither director nor Julianne Moore. Julianne Moore gives such a wonderful, subtle performance where she's doing a lot of actressy tricks that you're not noticing, but she's totally doing them to make you stay on her side, even as she continues to make one bad decision after another regarding, you know, the men she's around.
True.
And
but she comes off a lot better than her ex-husband when we meet him.
You keep rooting for her, and you do feel for the ex-husband, even though he's clearly, like, Brad Garrett plays the ex-husband, and he only has
one big scene,
10-minute chunk in the middle of the film. And he's given you a full character in this 10 minutes. Like, more than you ever thought you could get out of him from The Raymond Show. Mm. You feel all of his loss and all of his regret and all of his sadness and all of his jerkishness as well. Like, he's all of these things.
Yeah.
But this is really Julianne Moore's movie.
Oh, no question.
And She's dorky and she's, wounded by the marriage, the divorce. She's a little desperate sometimes, but she pulls herself back because she remembers, oh, wait, I can't be desperate. You know, it's lovely. It's a lovely movie.
Yeah.
Go see it if it's already gone from your town. Get it later.
Yeah.
See the original too, because they're both.
It's quite good. And Gloria's best pal at the office is played by Barbara Sacova.
Yes.
There's that.
Yes. Let's now talk about Three Faces.
Yes.
This is the new film. Go on.
This is the fourth film that Jafar Panahi has made since officially being barred by the government of Iran from making movies. There are times I think, why would I be worried about them having a nuclear program? They can't even stop Jafar Panahi from making movies. And I have still never seen any of the pre-injunction films, but I've now seen three of the four that he's made since the house arrest was established.
Yeah.
And I think they're great.
They are.
This one might be my favorite of the ones that I've seen.
So before the house arrest, they put him under house arrest and barred him from making movies for 20 years.
Right.
Okay. But before that, he made a film called Offside.
Mm-hmm.
About a young girl trying to disguise herself as a boy so that she can go see a football game. One called The Circle, which is harrowing. It's about, women in trouble and sort of on the run, in Tehran. Back in the 90s...
Is he White Balloon?
He made The White Balloon. Okay. Did you see The White Balloon?
I've never seen The White Balloon. Okay.
Man, I saw The White Balloon at the AMC Glen Lakes in Dallas, Texas. Ooh. That's a long time ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it opened because it was a big deal. I remember The White Balloon was a big hit.
Yeah.
And that was his first feature.
Oh, wow.
White Balloon. Yeah. I mean, he'd made some documentaries before then. He made short films and a documentary before then. But this is his first narrative feature.
Scripted feature.
The White Balloon was about a little girl who has to... get home before the sundown, like the Sabbath, whatever the Muslim religion has that's a Sabbath time, or I don't know enough about it. Anyway, I don't remember the film enough.
Doesn't you have to get a goldfish for some holiday?
Yeah. It's been 24 years since I've seen the film. So anyway, great films before the arrest. And entirely different films after, but also really, really amazing. And this one is, describe it.
So we open on what appears to be sort of phone camera footage of this young girl talking about how she wants to be an actress and she studied really hard, but now her family won't let her and they're trying to marry her off instead. And she's sending this message to this famous actress and she's getting more and more upset and she's walking through this cave and she finally gets to this place where there's like a noose hanging from a branch. And it would appear that she like hangs herself and drops the phone. And a friend of hers sends the video to this famous actress who is very upset when she receives it. And so she gets Jafar Panahi. Everybody's playing themselves in this movie.
Yeah.
She is with Madame Jafari is the actress. And she gets Mr. Panahi to drive her to this.
Her name is Behnaz Jafari.
Behnaz Jafari.
And she's been in a lot of Iranian films.
Okay.
Yeah.
So she gets Panahi to drive her to this remote village where they seem to speak Turkish instead of Farsi. And, she has to know if this is true or if it's a hoax or whatever. And so it's the whole thing of entering into this very kind of, remote village, which is very insular and they have their own way of doing things, trying to find out what they can about the girl, because they think that if she did kill herself, the family might have kept it hidden. And so that's why, they're trying to find clues and stuff. And, at one point, like the villagers are thrilled to see them because they recognize her from television and they figure that they're there to like fix the problems that they're having with like the utilities and
we
stuff.
We saw you on TV. please fix the electricity.
Exactly. And they're like, no, we're looking for this girl. And they're like, ugh, her. You know, we find out that the family is horrified by the notion that she wants to become an entertainer, which is the word they keep using.
Right.
And so, anyway, so over the course of this time in this town, the movie never comes out and says it, but this movie is so much about gender roles in contemporary Iran. There's a whole lengthy discussion regarding, like, there's a woman who lives in town who used to be an actress before the revolution.
Yes.
And she's sort of treated as an outcast. There's a lengthy thing about this guy who is trying to get his son's foreskin buried in the right place so that God will bless his life, you know, to lead him towards certain careers.
Right. And he already has 3 or 4 daughters, and you don't hear a word about his hopes for them.
Yeah. Doesn't, it's all about the son.
Yeah.
Panahi, you know, when the first film they did, This Is Not a Film, was literally shot entirely inside the confines of the apartment where he's under house arrest. And managed to he started sort of laying out the film that he wanted to make, you know, just using these pieces of paper on the floor. And here there are these long takes where, like, the camera moves, but it's one long uninterrupted take.
Yeah.
It feels very much kind of like, it's almost like Locke in that, like, this is like, you've got him and the actress and a camera and an SUV and go. I was fascinated by this movie.
The slippage between fiction and documentary.
Yeah.
Because his filmmaking style is very much, it's very documentary-like.
Yes.
There's no, you know, stylistic flourishes
at all. It feels very fly on the wall.
He points a camera, everything goes.
There are moments where the actress goes places and the camera stays with Panahi.
Yes.
So we don't know what's happening until she comes back later and tells us.
She tells it. But there's also this slippage between, you know, what's real and what's fiction. Not just in terms of the style of the film, but the fact that the people play themselves, you know, or versions of themselves.
Sure. And the plot itself.
there's also this idea of in the title, you know, you've got, the title refers to two faces that you see and one that you cannot see. And you cannot see her because she's lost to time. And you can see the established actress for the bulk of the film because somehow or other, she gets to still have a career outside of being in a film by a man who's been legally forbidden to make films. Like, I don't know how she will get around this. But it's very significant that her face is on camera in a Jafar Panahi film. Mm. And then, of course, you see the young girl at the beginning of the film.
Well, and there's also the thing where, like, the young girl is being forbidden to be an actress because that's such a horrible thing. But at the same time, this woman is revered.
They revere her, and no one ever says, well, it's different for you. And no one ever explains why they love someone they've seen on television, forbid one of their own from trying to do the same thing.
Right.
And will badmouth the very profession to the woman that is on television that they claim to love so much.
Yeah. And the third woman, you know, treat her like an outcast.
She's
because,
a pariah
because she danced.
She danced.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's even a whole thing about at one point when it looks like they might be leaving the town, the road is blocked by this bull, which leads to this long monologue about what a stud the bull is. It's like, there's like gender keeps coming up in this movie over and over again in different ways.
The humor in the film is very pointed and yet at the same time, It very much like everything else in the film, it can act as simply an amusing situation. What I love so much about Jafar Panahi's films is that they are daring and political, yet he never is strident about anything. He...
Or even prickly angry.
Well, there's anger there. But it is so well coded and, you know, smoothed over that he can still get away with doing what he's doing. His films are political in the way that all films are political, but these are very pointedly political films in ways that don't draw attention to themselves. It never feels like you're being lectured to. It never feels like you're being taught a lesson. It never feels like someone's sitting you down and saying, I'm going to teach you how to be a socialist. Like, it's not it's not like that at all.
Right.
And the films wouldn't work if they were. They would just be, you know, shouting and angry and... Yeah. And
diatribes.
And, yeah, I like that they are not polemical.
Yeah, and he certainly, I think, if any filmmaker on Earth has the right to make that kind of movie, it would be him, but he's choosing not to.
Right. Okay, High Life.
Yes. Why don't you explain this one?
Happy Claire Denis Day, everybody. One of my favorite living filmmakers has a new movie out this week. Here's what happens. There's a spaceship. It is on a mission. It is populated by death row inmates. They might have been tricked into going onto this ship. They all volunteered. I think they thought perhaps that it was going to be something they would get to do instead of being killed. But then they learned that, no. You have to fly this ship into a black hole for science. By the way, you're all going to die when it happens. Robert Pattinson is the he's the main character here. Although he's one of many prisoners on the ship. Mia Goth, Andre Benjamin, a.k.a. Andre 3000 from Outkast. Juliette Binoche, who is herself a death row criminal, a woman who has on Earth murdered her own children, and who should not be in charge of everybody, but the captain dies, and so she takes over.
Well, she's clearly the only... I would hazard a guess that she's the only sort of educated person on the ship.
It would appear that she is, yeah. She is a scientist.
Yeah.
A mad scientist.
She went from murdering her kids to being obsessed with procreation.
Her experiments consist of forced reproduction and all of the rape that that entails. So...
Against men and women.
Content warning, yeah. Content warning if you are particularly sensitive to that subject. This is not the film for you. Because one thing that Claire Denis does not flinch from is the realistic depiction of people being horrible, cruel, and violent to each other, including sexually violent. This is for a purpose. She is a filmmaker who has long explored the most dire of human behavior in her films. Not always. She has a series of films in her resume that are very gentle and thoughtful and loving. I mean, they're all thoughtful, but you know what I mean. Like, films about people who really care about each other instead of people who are trying to tear each other to pieces.
Right.
35 Shots of Rum, for example.
Let the Sunshine In.
35 Shots of Rum, specifically as it relates to this movie, is about a very strong bond between a father and his adult daughter. This movie is about the bond, ultimately, between Robert Pattinson and his baby daughter. The lone experiment success to survive the intense radiation that they are all experiencing on this
vessel.
Shipping cargo container?
Yeah, this cube.
It's just a box that just floats through space. A box designed, I will say, brilliantly by contemporary artist Olafur Eliasson, in a way that strips away all of the utopian design of spaceships in movies.
Yeah, this is of the Dark Star school.
Yeah, you're it's a cube. Here's your room. It's a cot. Good luck.
I have never seen an outer space movie dwell more on the recycling and other uses of bodily fluids than this movie.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a second. There's a struggle for power on the strip, on the ship, between Juliette Binoche and Robert Pattinson. I won't give things away, but it is a Luke Skywalker versus Darth Vader kind of thing. In its own way.
If Darth Vader had hair down to his butt.
Yeah. This is a film that is set in outer space, and yet it is about life on Earth right now. And really, all science fiction
is
in one way or another. This is a group of people who are... This is a line of dialogue I didn't realize wound up in the trailer, because I avoided the trailer.
Mm-hmm.
Until I saw the film. Line of dialogue that winds up in the trailer where Robert Pattinson describes the experience that they're in as moving backward even though we are moving forward.
Right.
And
he's talking about relativity, but
there's that push and pull throughout the entire film, but it is very much about, like, the minute you hear him say that in the film, if you haven't seen the trailer, you think, oh, okay, life on Earth right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. There is the suggestion that the mission they are on is somehow related to an environmental catastrophe taking place or about to take place on Earth. We don't even know at one point in the film if Earth is still around, because all the messages from Earth sort of go silent.
Well, and it was going to take a long time for messages to move either way anyway.
Years. Like, at one point, Robert Pattinson says to Andre Benjamin, oh, your kid's an old man now.
Yeah.
You know, like, you're writing him a letter, but your kid's old now. It's like, he'll be dead by the time that letter even gets to him. Maybe this is because I'm always in the tank for Claire Denis, but man, do I love this movie. It's not a lovable movie.
I was going to say.
It is not a film that fills you with affection, but it is a film that, for me, as cold and as unsentimental and as unsparing as Claire Denis is, you know, her approach to narrative is often about visual representation rather than people telling you things, even though Pattinson narrates quite a bit of it in voiceover. There are always portions of her films that just are sort of left unexplained. You have to make the jump. And that's what I love. I love how she makes me work. I love how she won't give you the thing you want, not just in terms of narrative, but in terms of, could we leave this movie with a little bit of hope? And her answer was always, no, I'm sorry, I can't. There will be no salvation, but there will be the possibility of love. It's not exactly the same.
I mean, this movie almost fooled me into thinking it was leaving me with a sense of hope until I thought more about it. I was like, oh, no, never mind. I found this movie profoundly unpleasant. But
it is distressing.
But quite a bit. I could also tell that's exactly what she was going for. Mm-hmm. So, you know, kudos, you know.
Yeah, because I can't say, you can't say you love a film where people are being raped.
Yeah.
But I love the effect of this film, and I love what she's making happen here.
Yeah, I admire her...
her tenacity.
Her uncompromising vision.
Yeah, yeah.
And her efficacy at reaching the results that she sought. Did I enjoy those results? No, I did not. But those were her results, and that's where we got. So.
It's that thing where you know you've seen a good movie and you never want to see it again.
Exactly.
I want to go see it again.
No,
because
thank you.
I love her filmmaking so much that I want to see more of what I might have missed.
Right. Yeah, I see why you like her so much, but as with so many things that you like.
Yeah.
You know,
and I can't
death metal.
I can't wait to take you to Beau Travail.
Yeah, yeah, we'll see.
Her masterpiece, 1999's Beau Travail, playing this week in Los Angeles. Already got our tickets for it. Very exciting.
Maybe.
Oh, you're going. Mm. Oh, you're going. Mm. Oh, you're going.
You know what? If I go.
You're going.
Then it counts as a make me, and then I get to make you watch something.
Sure, fine.
So we'll see.
I want to be more clear about what I really love here.
Okay.
That tenderness between Pattinson and the baby actress who gets her...
Yes.
She gets her own... title card credit at the end.
She's very good.
She's a very good baby. I read a thing after I saw the movie. They cast a baby that would start screaming and crying every time Pattinson picked her up.
Mm.
And he was like, what am I supposed to do? I can't. This is not, like, she's not supposed to be screaming and crying through the whole film. They replaced the baby with the baby of some friends of his. So it was a baby he already knew. Yeah. So she was already used to him. Funny. So that's the baby. And then the teenage version of the daughter. They are so... He's so protective of her and so caring for her that it did quite remind me a lot of 35 Shots of Rum.
Huh.
And the way the film ends is so sorrowful, and yet, like, this, the ultimate most impossible decision that a father would have to make for himself and his child. Mm. And so that's, when I say I love it, that's what I'm really getting at. And just the fact that it's another Claire Denis movie, and I can go see it at the ArcLight 5 times a day if I feel like it.
You have fun.
Listen, I've had to drive to so many far-flung locations to see her films. It's amazing what having a name brand actor and no subtitles will do for your that'll do for
suddenly
your
A24 comes sniffing around.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm reminded of the junket that they were on earlier this year, where they all posed for a photograph, the entire cast. Pattinson, Binoche, Mia Goth, and I can't remember now who else. Might have been actually Claire Denis, where none of them were smiling. And Wendy Williams showed the photo on her show and scolded all of them and said, is it going to kill you to smile for the photographers? You're out here on a film junket. You better, this is my favorite quote of all time, you better twerk it and work it.
Well, maybe
she then described Juliette Binoche as some French actress.
Yes. Marking the second time that Wendy Williams had no idea who a French woman who happened to be an Oscar winner was. Because when there were rumors that Brad Pitt was having an affair with Marion Cotillard, she referred to her as that Marion.
That Marion lady. Man, do I love Wendy Williams.
Well, you know, I hope so too. But maybe if she'd seen High Life, she would know why no one was smiling.
Listen, I do not wish the movie High Life on Wendy Williams
right
now.
No, not right
She's
now.
Going She's going through a tough time.
This is not the moment.
This is not a movie. Listen,
Go see Shazam.
As incredible as I think this film is, I will tell you, and not just because there's so much like sexual violence in the film, it's not going to make anyone happy. You're not going to be happy when it's over.
No.
You will have seen a good movie, but if you're not feeling up to it, this is not the movie. As much as I admire it, and as much as I think it's fantastic.
If you are looking for uplift, however...
Oh, my God. Oh, God. Please, start talking about it.
Amazing Grace opened this weekend. I have
chills up and down my spine.
So this is the sort of legendary lost film. Back in 1972, when Aretha Franklin was recording her soon-to-become legendary live gospel album, Amazing Grace... in the Calvary Baptist Church in Los Angeles.
Yes.
Warner Brothers sent Sidney Pollack, who had just been nominated for Best Director for They Shoot Horses, Don't They?, to shoot the sessions for what was probably going to be a TV special or something. Well, apparently, as legend has it, Mr. Pollack did not do a clapperboard thing at the beginning of the shots, so the sound sync was next to impossible. And so for years it sort of sat on the shelf, and there were attempts in 2012 and 2015 to get it reissued or screened at festivals, and Aretha Franklin always blocked it. And then after she passed, they took it to the estate and got their approval to finally release the film.
Yeah.
Apparently, thanks to digital technology, they were able to sync up the stuff. So we are living in an era where The Other Side of the Wind and this film have been completed, which is a miracle. And so, it is basically this documentary of her performing with Reverend James Cleveland and his Southern California Community Choir. Two nights of gospel music, which she was raised on. And there's a scene where we get to know her father, who's a Baptist minister, Dr. C.J. Franklin, I believe is his name. And it's just this incredible, incredible performance piece, and it's breathtaking.
As punk rock as I grew up, there was nobody like her.
Hmm.
Her voice is one of the great wonders of the 20th century. I say this all the time. I've quoted this so many times. I'm sure y'all are expecting me to say it, but Don Cornelius said it on Soul Train one day when she was there. Oh, and she would never lip sync on Soul Train, by the way. It was always live. He before he introduced her, he said, "You are lucky to be alive at a time when she is alive and singing." And he's not wrong. She's not alive anymore, but we get to have her forever. There is nothing more thrilling than listening to her sing. It doesn't matter what she's singing, go to YouTube and watch those old Soul Train clips of her singing Oh Me Oh My, especially Oh Me Oh My, or anything.
Yeah, when she was recording this album, she had just had 11 consecutive
number one songs.
Yes.
She was about 30 when this happened.
Mm-hmm.
She was kind of at the height of her power.
Yeah.
And one of the things that's so beautiful about watching her sing, not just hearing her, but watching her perform back then, is there was always an immense smile on her face. And it's, you feel her feeling herself. Like, she's thrilled to be able to sing like this. She's thrilled to get to do it for you. She's thrilled with her own power.
Like, she's a vessel.
She's thrilled in this scenario because she's singing songs that she grew up singing about God, which always meant a lot to her. There is a sort of satisfaction on her face, knowing, I think, that she knows how to make this song sound, you know, sound like only she can make it sound. Her approach to, like, laying it all down or holding back or, you know, working to make a shape with her mouth to make the sound do the thing that it's doing.
Yeah.
It's all under her control. She's thinking about it every moment. It's not like she's unconscious of this. It's not like this raw talent that she doesn't know what to do with.
She's sculpting it.
She knows exactly what she's doing every second. And it's overwhelming to be in a movie theater with her face huge in front of you and watch her like work and just deliver this to you in a way that's sort of like, yeah, that's for you. I just did that. You like it? I know you like it. It's I can't wait to go watch this movie again.
And this is one that you really should see in a theater.
If you can see it in a theater, do. If you can't, like right now, I'm looking at Box Office Mojo right now. It is on 8 screens nationwide.
It's going to make its way around. Like, see it because you want that full Dolby whatever mix going on.
Even if you ain't got Dolby, even if you see it in some crappy little movie
theater, you just want those speakers to blow
you want the speakers to be loud and you want her face to be towering above you.
This is a faith-based film. This is a movie about people singing about God.
It is.
And as such, I found it far more powerful than, with the exception of like First Reformed, no movie about faith has, it's not my thing, but I understand where they're coming from, and I feel the power of their belief in listening to her, in listening to that choir, in seeing the people respond to this music, and it is so forcefully portrayed in this film.
I could have done without 3 different cuts to Mick Jagger sitting in the audience. Like, show him once. I don't need 2 more times.
Yeah.
Whoever edited the film in this final state, I didn't need every shot of Mick Jagger to make
one was
the final cut. I swear, although I can't be certain, that I saw soul singer Barbara Roy in the audience. Like on the second night, she was in a.
The fun thing about it being shot over 2 nights is you do start noticing some of the same faces in the audience, and they definitely dress better on the second night. Like, they realize just how many cameras there are in the room, and so like they're turning it out even more.
Yeah,
and because this was filmed in 1972, the outfits are great.
Oh, the outfits are staggering. Anyway, Barbara Roy was in a 70s R&B group called Ecstasy, Passion, and Pain. Go look them up on Soul Train 2. They will knock you down. She was a force all by herself. I don't know if it was her, but boy, did it look just like her.
Huh. Could be.
And the same hair, and this, she has very sort of distinctive sort of expression on her face that I've seen many times on video.
Gotcha.
From watching old videos on YouTube. Anyway, I who knows? Someone go ask Barbara Roy.
If she was there.
She's now singing gospel like pretty much entirely now. But the back in the 70s, she was in a really cool group. But never had any crossover hits.
Huh.
They were all like on the R&B charts.
Gotcha.
But I thought they were famous because I was a child watching Soul Train, and I thought Soul Train was the world. Like, I didn't know. I didn't know it wasn't.
To me, Soul Train just meant cartoons were over.
To me, the end of American Bandstand meant, oh, Soul Train's on now. Because they were right after each other where I grew up. And Soul Train was more fun than American Bandstand.
Well, yeah, that's
always
that's a gimme.
Yeah.
Do we have time for letters? Do we have time to do anything else?
We do not have time for letters this week.
Okay.
Because I got to go roast a chicken.
Okay, fine.
So why don't you tell people about the Patreon? Make it sweet and short. It's fine if you don't like lay it on thick.
All right.
All right.
So we have a Patreon and lots of people like it, and maybe you will too. If you like this show, you'll get more shows like it. You get LKTV, a podcast of the television. You'll get Linoleum Knife and Fork, a food podcast hosted by two film critics. And even Linoleum Nights, where we say bad swears and talk about
real bad swears.
Controversial topics.
Yeah.
You know, and we have fun Google Hangouts for members. We have private podcasts that you can custom order for you and you alone. T-shirts. You know, other prizey, swaggy things.
Stuff.
So yeah, patreon.com/linoleumknife.
Yeah.
Think about it, won't you? And thank you for listening. Go check out our friends on the internet. I'll spare you the long list. But yeah, you can listen to Who Shot You over at MaximumFun.org and Breakfast All Day. We're on the podcast places and we're on YouTube. So check us out there. You can subscribe to this show, Linoleum Knife, for free at Apple Podcasts. Leave us that 5-star review. It does a great deal of good for us in helping people find the show. You can also leave us thumbs ups and stars and other positive feedback in all the places that we stream, like Stitcher Radio and thelounge.com and Spotify and Google Play and CastBox and Podbean and all those joints. We are on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at LinoleumCast. You can follow me on Twitter at A Duraldi, A D as in David, U R A L D E. And you can follow Dave at D Leland White, D L E L A N D, W H I T E. And you can always drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
H E double hockey stick.
Yes, indeed. All right. We'll catch up on those letters next time.
We'll get
you
letters. I promise. We'll get you letters.
All right. So,
You know what we didn't do? Also, we didn't do DVD picks or streaming picks or anything like that.
Well, okay. You know what? Go. 35 Shots of Rum is Dave's DVD pick.
It really is.
And the original.
Probably recommended it before, but you go watch
and
it.
And the original Gloria is my DVD pick. And so, bam, done. Thank you. Until next time.
Sorry. Goodbye.